All right, Dean, you're in big trouble. There we go. Okay. There's an old axiom that says, the only constant in our lives is change. And sometimes we feel that way, don't we? Sometimes we're just bombarded by it, really. Today, I'd like all of us, whether you're here for the very first time or whether you're a longtime member, I'd like all of us just to think of a change that we are experiencing right now or maybe have recently experienced in the past. I'd like you just to think about that. It could be a job change, an address or marital status change, a change in finances, a season change we're all going through right now, global change, climate change, or the change that comes about with the loss, or the retirement, I should say, of a beloved minister that some of us can identify with right now. An educator, actually, I need to preface this by saying, you know, change is so prevalent in our lives, and yet sometimes it's not our favorite thing, is it? It really isn't. Educator Roy Blitzer said, the only human being who likes change is a wet baby. However, from personal recent experience with our grandson, a wet baby might want change, but he or she does not want to stay still and endure the process, right? It happens. It absolutely happens. So, certainly as adults, our resistance to change is more subconscious and subtle, isn't it? We don't wail, maybe. Some of us might. But we do sometimes stubbornly cling to the current and the familiar. And possibly our resistance to change is rooted in the fear of losing control, maybe. Maybe in the fear of failure. We're afraid to move forward because we're not sure how it's going to go. Or in that most universal of all fears, simply the fear of the unknown. And sometimes we even resist change when change is our idea. I remember several years ago, I had applied for a new job, and that job would involve my moving from teaching kids to working with and teaching adults, administrators, and teachers. And I'd applied for the job. I thought it was the perfect job for me, but I remember the day I got the phone call saying that I had gotten the position. I remember standing there, hearing that news, and going, okay. And my supervisor-to-be, who was on the other end, said, I received more enthusiasm from that than the people who didn't get the position. And I was like, well, and we laughed about it later. But at that moment, all I could think about was what I was giving up. That I was giving up teaching children, and I loved doing that for so many years. That I was giving up my colleagues, my school community. I was giving up my professional life as I knew it. And so, even when it's our idea, every new beginning, every change or transition is actually an ending, a releasing of the old. And it can be even worse when changes are thrust upon us, those ready or not changes that can leave us feeling like the bottom has dropped out of our world. So in the book, Finding Yourself in Transition by Robert Brummett, he explores the spiritual opportunities inherent in life's changes. He sees the process of change falling into three main stages, very simple ones. First of all, there has to be that end that we just talked about. Then secondly, there's the void, some time in the void. And then lastly and finally, we move into the new beginning. Now, he says that in our Western culture, we're a lot better at celebrating beginnings than we are endings. And I think that's true. We celebrate births more than deaths. We celebrate weddings more than divorces. I mean, I think we're focused on beginnings. But Brummett maintains that it's very important for us to also honor and celebrate those endings. And that's what we did last week, those of us who were here to participate in Randy's party. When I was kind of arguing with him about whether we would have a party, I said, Randy, this party's for you, but this party is also for all of us to say goodbye and honor your work with us. So in our personal lives and in our church change, I don't think we can really launch ahead to a new beginning until we have fully dealt with the ending that preceded it. And that can bring up a myriad of feelings. It can bring up anger. It can bring up fear. I got those mixed up. The first one is fear, the second one is anger. It can bring up abandonment, feeling abandoned. It can bring up guilt, and it can bring up grief. And certainly these feelings will eventually pass. Of course they will. We know they will. But at the time we're feeling them, they are real. Sometimes in unity, I think we're just too good at going around telling each other, it's all good, it's all good, everything is good, when our hearts might be breaking. Yes, I affirm that we're going to bring good. We bring good to all endings. But at the time, we need to feel what we feel. We need to take that time to work through those feelings and process them. And for some of us, that might mean talking it out. For others, it might be writing. I mean, there are lots of ways that we can go through our feelings, but we can all go through our feelings by taking them into prayer and meditation and eventually getting to the place where we can release what needs to be released. Now, one of the best biblical examples of the whole change process is the story of the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt. You'll remember that the Hebrews had originally moved to Egypt because of a famine in Canaan. But instead of returning home right away, they stayed, and their numbers grew so large that the Pharaoh became worried that the Hebrews would become more powerful than he was and overthrow his rule. So he turned them all into slaves. And during this roughly 400 years of bondage, the Hebrew people were treated cruelly. This is a picture from a tomb in 15 BC. A farm overseer is thrashing a slave while another slave begs for mercy. Now, this certainly looks like a good time for change, does it not? I mean, it does. But according to the book of Exodus, Moses actually comes upon a scene just exactly like this. And Exodus 2 tells us Moses saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his kinsfolks. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. But evidently, Moses did not hide him very well, because the very next day, the deed is discovered. And this shows us that when we work through the change process, burying our feelings never works. It's a primary law of consciousness, really, that what is hidden will eventually be revealed. And as a result, we all know the story, Moses is forced to flee into the desert. Eventually, of course, divine order prevails, and he returns to Egypt, following God's instructions at the burning bush to set the people free. Charles Fillmore tells us that metaphysically, we are in Egypt anytime we experience any type of bondage, limitation, or unhappiness. And as we know, the ending of bondage does not come very quickly for the Hebrew people, just as some of our life endings do not come very easily to us. Remember, it took 10 plagues before Pharaoh holds to his word to release the Israelites. And at the very least, Pharaoh taught Moses and us about the power of perseverance. Metaphysically, the word Pharaoh symbolizes the power of human consciousness. And sometimes it takes us several attempts to overcome that, doesn't it? I bet we can all think of situations in our life where that is true. Now, in the biblical account, after the 10th plague, Pharaoh is forced to let the people go, and they start rejoicing. They're just thrilled to be out of bondage. However, they don't get very far. Actually, they get about 25 miles, as represented by the red line on the screen. And that just shows us that since our human consciousness is always there trying to pull us back. And we'll pick up the story in Exodus 14:5. I'm skipping around a little bit. But when the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the minds of Pharaoh and his officials were changed toward the people. And they said, "What have we done, letting Israel leave our service?" So he had his chariot made ready, and took his army with him. He took 600 picked chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt, with officers all over them. He pursued the Israelites, who were going out boldly. As Pharaoh drew near, the Israelites looked back, and there were the Egyptians advancing on them. In great fear, the Israelites cried out to the Lord, and they said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in this wilderness? What have you done to us, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the very thing we told you? Let us alone and let us serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." But Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm and see the deliverance that the Lord will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to keep still." And so, standing in faith and relying on God's instructions, Moses raises his staff and parts the Red Sea, a powerful lesson for all of us in letting go of the past and stepping forward toward a new land. From an only human consciousness, we might, like the Hebrew people, no matter what change we're undergoing, we might become fearful and want to turn back to the same old, same old. The Egyptians symbolize an unawakened state. And Bible scholar Ed Townley says, whatever the Egyptians represent in our consciousness, fears, resentment, thoughts of lack or limitation, we could very well spend our whole lives running from them, trying to escape them, constantly looking over our shoulders to see if they are gaining on us. Or, instead, we can choose not to run, but to know that we're not facing our ending alone, that the Christ of our being can dissolve those Egyptians, those thoughts, those negative thoughts, and then the power and presence of God can lead us all to our ever-unfolding good. However, that new beginning for the Israelites doesn't happen immediately. They spend 40 years of wandering in the desert, and that takes us to the second stage of the change process, and that is the void. Sometimes the ending is as frightening as being pursued by the Egyptian army. Some endings of our lives are like that. However, Brummett says it's really in the void that we touch our deepest feelings of helplessness. Lost in the desert or adrift on an endless sea, the void can be a stage of unraveling, a stage of chaos and confusion, vulnerability, loss of identity. One of my dear friends who retired from teaching early said to me a few days afterwards, "I used to be a teacher. Now, what am I?" That loss of identity. So turning back to the Exodus, the Israelites were witness to many miracles during the time in the wilderness. It wasn't all challenge. They had many, many miracles. They had a cloud by day to lead them and a fire by night to warm them. Yet they were fearful and complained to God. When they were thirsty, the Lord purified bitter water. When they were hungry, God gave them manna to eat, but they complained about it. Even though God provided for every need, they wanted to return to the security of slavery instead of facing the unknown crises at hand. In Chinese, the word crisis actually is made of two characters. One is danger, but the other is opportunity. And the Israelites were just not ready, it seems, for the opportunity of a new life of freedom. Now, the wilderness where they wandered for 40 years represents undisciplined and uncultivated thoughts. In the middle of a transition or change, those kind of thoughts can serve as a barrier to the good God has in store for us. And that four square number of 40 symbolizes a foundation for something to follow, a time of preparation. Modern Bible scholars say the number 40 means as long as it takes. So we remain in that void, maybe, for as long as it takes us to work through our thoughts and feelings of uncertainty until we can turn our pivotal souls from the chaos to the truth of God's divine good. And the void is actually a passageway to becoming truly awake and alive. We just have to trust the process instead of fighting or trying to push everything. Brummett says, don't try to push the river. Just let the change process flow. And that means each day, each moment, we take it as it comes. We don't try to resurrect the past. We don't try to go back to our old way of life. That rarely works. We pray and meditate and trust in God and our own inner wisdom when we feel hopeless. And so we can work through all those stages. Now, the idea of letting all unfold in God's perfect divine timing is beautifully illustrated by a story from Kanatskis. Actually, I need my Greek son-in-law to pronounce that more correctly, but that's the best I can do. This is a story that you all have heard, I think, or many of you have heard. And it really illustrates this idea of just letting time pass without rushing through the process. I remembered one morning when I discovered a cocoon in the bark of a tree, just as a butterfly was making a hole in its case and preparing to come out. I waited a while, but it was too long appearing, and I was impatient. I bent over it and breathed on it to warm it and expedite the process. I warmed it as quickly as I could, and the miracle began to happen before my very eyes. The case opened, the butterfly started slowly crawling out, and I will never forget my horror when I saw that its wings were folded back and crumpled. That wretched butterfly tried with its whole trembling body to unfold them. Bending over it, I tried in vain with my breath to warm it, but nothing worked. It needed to be hatched out patiently, and the unfolding of the wings should have been a gradual process in the sun. Now it was too late. My breath had forced the butterfly to appear, all crumpled before its time. It struggled desperately, and in a few seconds, it died in the palm of my hand. That little body, I do believe, is the greatest weight I have on my conscience. For today, I realize that it's wrong to violate the great laws of nature. We should not hurry, we should not be impatient, but we must learn to confidently obey the eternal rhythm of our lives. And so it is with the process of change. And also, the void is a wonderful time to take stock of our resources. My friend who retired early and felt that sense of loss of her identity turned to something she loved and was good at doing. She had always made delicious, beautiful chocolate candies for her friends and colleagues at Christmas. And after retirement, she started selling her goodies at craft fairs and in specialty shops. And now she has a thriving small business. And considering our resources in our church's transition is important now too. And I'm not talking about this beautiful building. I'm not talking about the land that surrounds it. The most important resource we have is all the loving, talented people who are so devoted to this church. We have an incredible board, committed and highly trained prayer chaplains, an unparalleled ministry of music, and countless, countless talented volunteers, each doing his or her part, as evidenced by our work last week. And so beautiful in divine order and so typical, on this day, we have several new visitors. So welcome, you're part of our new beginning. And I don't think there's anything that this congregation could not accomplish if we set our minds to it. We are rich in resources. And so, no, the good news is we are definitely not going to spend 40 years wandering in the wilderness. We're not. I promise. But we're going to support each other during this time of transition, knowing that the best way to honor Randy and his work is to take this church, his legacy, forward. And in our personal lives, as well as in our church community, let's set the intention throughout this process to use the same resource that Moses followed, the voice of God, that inner voice of our own indwelling Christ. And in that process, we absolutely know that however long it takes, divine guidance will be revealed to us in new and unexpected ways. Once we have completed the inner work of those first two stages, we will be guided into the promised land into this new stage of new beginnings. And Brummett says the best approach is to be ready but not anxious, to be alert but not willful. In other words, to pray, to trust, and to know that our lives, our personal changes, and the life of this church are all in God's perfect divine order. And we will affirm that God's Spirit within gives us the strength, the courage, the will, and the faith to refuse, to absolutely refuse, to be down by circumstances. And while it is true, we all have to admit, that the rate of change today is faster than it's ever been throughout recorded history, and we are bombarded by changes all the time, I believe it's error thinking to think that change is the only constant. We have a much more viable constant. And by fully and completely just being in the presence of God and knowing that as we surrender to the change in our outer lives, we come to understand that which never changes, that which is eternally the same today, yesterday, today, and through all of our tomorrows. God's love is our one constant, and we are here, every single one of us is here, to be that love in expression. We are one with the Most High and one with each other, all interconnected and divinely guided, and we need to remember that what the caterpillar calls the end, God calls the butterfly. And as our many life changes, whether chosen or seemingly thrust upon us, only serve as opportunities for spiritual growth and soul transformation. In a poem by James Dillett Freeman entitled Change, he writes, just think of the change that you're going through in your own lives as you hear this poem. He writes, I have resisted change with all my will, cried out to life, pass by and leave me still. But I have found, as I have trudged time's track, that all my wishing would not hold life back. All finite things must go their infinite way. I cannot bid the merest moment stay. So finding I have no power to change, I have changed myself. And this is strange, but I have found out when I let change come, the very change that I was fleeing from has often held the good I had prayed for, and I was not the less for change, but more. Once I accepted life and was not loath to change, I found change was the seed of growth, and so it is. And so let's now just take some time to affirm that one constant in our lives, that there is only one presence and one power in the universe and in our lives, God the good, omnipotent. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in our lives, God the good, omnipotent, and so it is.